This is a recording of Clancy Emisland from Venice, California, taped at the 6th Summer Serenity in the Sierras Convention in Oakhurst, California, on August 24, 1991. In observance with our 11th tradition stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
My name is Clancy Emisland, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the first time I've ever spoken at a participation meeting. Very nice to be here. Let me explain. I have a little... It's a lonely job, but somebody's got to do it. As I travel around, little by little, it's going out like infected bubbles from the San Fernando Valley. But I notice now it's reached these Hollywood Hills. Or at the end of the tradition, people join in and say, principles before personalities. You may not know where that comes from. And I'm here to tell you where it comes from so you'll feel good. About 20 years ago, there was an old guy named Bill Davison, Wild Bill D., in the Canoga Park Group, and he was an old eccentric guy. He didn't like any authority. He didn't like central office. He didn't like New York. He didn't like sponsorship. He didn't like anything. We should just be free here. So they read the traditions, and he'd always join in and say, principles before personalities. And he'd keep saying that, and after a while, people got mocking him and joining in with him. And then some people came and heard this and thought it was something spiritual and took it to their group, and now it's in a lot of places. But the next time you do it, remember, you are not spiritual. You are just mocking that crazy poor old Bill Davidson. That may help you with that. I have no idea why people shout, run, when they're reading the steps. The only time I ever saw him do that was in the Texas State Hospital. And the ones that did it are still there. Is there anybody I haven't offended yet? I'm very pleased to be here. I wanted to spend the weekend, but my wife is up in Washington presiding over the birth of a grandchild. And my daughter, who you planned to come up, couldn't come up. So we are. My wife is an animal loving woman, and we have 9 dogs and 2 cats and a Shetland pony and 2 parrots and 150 pigeons and 3 chickens. And so I had to wait there today to take care of all those creatures. And tomorrow morning I have to leave early before Duffy talks and home and feed him in the morning. So I'm missing my pleasure of staying up here. But I really love it up here. Except for the mountains, it's very similar to, it looks like Wisconsin. If they took Wisconsin and made it kind of mountainous, because that's the way it is, grass and trees. But even in the short time I've been here tonight, it hasn't been very pleasant for me. My host, Dave, wonderful man, took me up to my room, up in the very top building up there. Where you? I said, who's that guy out there? He said, I don't know, I'm just flying American Airlines to Fresno. He gave me a lovely room. It's called the Oak Room, and he would like to join me after a while. It's a double room, has 2 sofas, 2 desks, 2 washrooms, no bed. So if you hear a lot of pacing in the middle of the night, you'll know who it is. But all I've heard since I've been here really is, I heard that Laurie gave such a wonderful talk last night, and then, Karen was just wonderful this morning. She was just wonderful. Got Annette, I'm almost sorry she got her voice back. Yeah. Oh, she's so wonderful. Much better than you be. And what people weren't saying, they were saying, oh, we're looking forward to hearing Duffy tomorrow. It's always a thrill to hear Duffy. And so I'm just here to help you digest your food before the dance.
That's
I got to remember not to talk too long either, because sometimes I have gotten in a couple of situations where I've got caught up in what I was saying and didn't realize anything was wrong until the first couple started dancing by. That's always a little humiliating when you're just up to the second step. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I really am. Pleasure to see a lot of old friends and new friends, and it's always a great thing. Glad to see the archives. You know, this is kind of a, this is an anniversary year for our organization. Kind of a significant anniversary. Started it all. Some of you know, I'm sure, that alcoholism is, or at least an unnatural reaction to alcohol, they didn't call it alcoholism, has been present in written records as long as there have been fermented beverages. And in every generation, there always seems to be a small percentage of people who get some, who act differently when they drink alcohol or fermented beverages, whatever it might be. And they never knew what it was, but they knew it was something bad. And at one time they thought they were possessed by the devil, and sometimes they were put to death, and more commonly put in insane asylums and jails and treated with obloquy. For about 4,000 years they've been working on this unnatural reaction. And the odd thing is, though, that's, I'm sure we have some new people here who take this organization for granted, because we all do. But in my lifetime, when I was a little boy in the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and in school, when I was in school, they still had not found any kind of an answer to this illness after 4,000 years, which makes this anniversary kind of significant. Most people wouldn't think it was an anniversary for us, but it really is. 60 years ago this summer, there was a family in the East who had a son, grown-up son, who was one of these people who seemed to be very nice sometimes, but sometimes he was very nervous and neurotic, and he drank a lot. And when he drank, he acted much differently. And they were very much upset by it. So they, Depression, 1931, but they had a lot of dough, so they found the best doctor and the best psychiatrist in the world and sent their son there with a blank check, this old man, really, saying, "Doctor, we don't care what you do, just take care of our son." That was 60 years ago. And the doctor said, "Okay." Grist for his mill, put him in his hospital in Switzerland, worked with him every day for a year, and got him totally straightened up, got to the root of his problems, saw the causes for his conflicts, got the id and superego back in some sort of relationship, and he released him. And the guy said, "Thank you very much, doctor," and went home. Didn't even get to a ship, was face down in his own vomit, drunk in France. And the parents were appalled, and he was appalled, and the doctor was appalled, and so they got some wire cable and got some people in France to take care of him, bring him back to Switzerland, put him back in the hospital. And so they brought him to the hospital, and the only significant part about this story is what happened then, because it's something we have to remember, but we so easily take this for granted. The doctor refused to take him back. And they said, "Why are you refusing to take him back? We got a blank check, we're willing to pay." He said, "No, that's not the point." He said, "In effect, I misdiagnosed this young man. I thought he had deep psychological problems, and I thought I could help him. But I see now that he is what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no successful treatment for that condition in the world today at any cost." So in the summer of 1932, which isn't very long ago, the best doctor in the world had never heard of a successful answer to this illness, this strange phenomenon, this unnatural reaction. And this guy was pretty upset about it, of course. He said, "What does this mean, doctor? What does this mean to me?" The doctor says, "Well, Roland, what it means to you is this. You will either have to keep yourself confined, either voluntarily or involuntarily, as long as you live, or you almost certainly will intermittently drink to excess until you die or go mad. That's all I can offer you. Now that's pretty staggering. He says, is there nothing else? And I said, well, I've seen some cases in the literature. I've never seen one personally, but I've seen some cases where there's been a severe, intense, involuntary change of the psyche. These people call it some sort of a spiritual experience. I wouldn't call it that, but that's what they call it. He said, but your chances of being hit by lightning are better than that. Because they happen without rhyme or reason. To maybe 1 in 5 million, 1 in 10 million. So this young man, in the summer of 1932, came home. And the doctor had convinced him. He didn't get drunk this time. He went to that ship, a kind of a stupor, got on the ship. And I guess on that ship he did something that all of us have to do, although we're not always familiar with it, but we're doing it. He surrendered to the fact he was hopeless. He just came to the conclusion, there's no way out. But he came back determined to stay sober a while anyway. As he wrote later, I wanted to stay sober as long as I could, so my parents would have a pleasant memory of me when I died drunk. Now he heard about the spiritual experience, and the doctor told him it had nothing to do with churches or religions, just seemed to be something else. So there was a thing going on, we've all heard the name, there's something called the Oxford Group. A lot of people don't know what the Oxford Group was. You could compare it today to an organization like EST, upper middle class, well-to-do people, not down and outers, except that EST was seeking psychological breakthroughs, and they were looking for spiritual understandings. So he started to go to this Oxford Group to stay sober as long as he could. And he stayed sober. And he thought the Oxford Group had done it for him. Of course, we would be able to say it didn't, because there was a lot of Oxford Group people who couldn't stay sober. One of these spiritual leaders of Ohio this time was a man named Dr. Bob Smith. And he was drunk most of the time. So he stayed sober a while. And I'm not going to go into some long history, but I think it's these little things just sent a shiver down my spine. His parents said, Roland, you're really doing well. Why don't you take a couple of weeks off and go to our home in Vermont and relax, have a little vacation. Great, at your convenience. So arbitrarily, he just chose 2 weeks in the summertime again and went to Vermont. Now, the interesting part about that story is, if he'd gone 2 weeks earlier, we would not be in this camp tonight. If we'd gone 2 weeks later, I might still be dying in the insane asylum in Texas or someplace. It just, well, that's funny to you, not funny to me. But he just had to go there at exactly the right time by coincidence. So the first week he was there, some guy said, hey, this guy you used to know when you lived in Vermont, he's in real deep trouble drinking, and you used to drink. Why don't you talk to him? So we went over and talked to him. The guy didn't want to hear it. Oh, really, Roland? Come on, get off it. Christ, leave me alone. The second week, while he was there, the same guy ran his car into a house, was arrested, brought to court as a violation of his strict probation, and was about to be sentenced to the Vermont State Penitentiary. And these people got a hold of Roland again, said, Roland, I know he kind of burned you off last week, but won't you come over and put in a good word to the judge, he'll listen to you, he won't listen to us. So Roland said, okay. So Roland went over there and he said, Judge, I know this guy's been very guilty, but what do you say if I get him out of Vermont? Would you release him in my custody? I'll take him to New York and put him in this thing called the Oxford Group. Maybe you'll straighten him out. The judge says, I wouldn't do it for anybody except you, but I know your family, and I know that your father and I are good friends. I believe you. Take him with you, but keep him out of Vermont. If he comes back here, he'll have to go to the penitentiary. So now we have two people in this chain. Still no members of AA, but we've got two people. One is just trying to stay sober long enough so his parents won't think he's goofy. The other one doesn't want to be sober at all. He just doesn't want to go to the Vermont penitentiary. So they go to the Oxford Group for a while. Then the time comes in the usher group, what you had to do after you was there a while, you had to testify to what you found. And you know, this guy from Vermont, he didn't want to testify. It's humiliating. You'll find somebody to testify to. Look what I found. I found God and Jesus. He said, I don't want to testify and roll to see. You don't want to go to the Vermont Penitentiary, is it? No, I believe I'll testify. But he had to find some place to testify where he wouldn't be humiliated. And he happened to think that he knew a guy, Roland had never heard of him, but he knew him, that he used to drink with, who'd moved to New York, was a big failure, lost everything, a down and out loser in every way. He said, I bet I could testify that son of a bitch, you won't even remember it. So he found this guy over in Brooklyn, a guy named Bill Wilson, and he went over there to testify to Bill Wilson. Now we read in the book, Bill made it a little bit better than he remembered it at the time, but you know, he said, I was there and Ebby came in and told me how he'd found God and he impressed me, but that little poetic license. What happened, Ebby came in there, or Ebby and others later, and he tried to tell Bill about what he'd found, and Bill reacted just the way I hoped that you and I would in that same condition, you know. Yeah, that's really wonderful, Abby. Could you hand me that gin bottle there behind you? Next time you mention Jesus. So, Abby was not happy about this. He being put down by this loser. So he left. And he came back 3 days later. This is not in our big book, but this is a fact. And he had the Oxford Group closer with him. And the guy said, I'm going to tell you about God. And Bill Wilson, I'm happy to say, reacted the way he should. Went off in the goddamnest trunk of his career, you know. He spent days roaming around. He's in Manhattan, went to the mission where Ebby had lived and couldn't find Ebby. Gave said a few words to the assembled down and outers and stayed around. And wound up in the hospital, as was his wont, this loser. And of all the people, it turned out that he was the one in 5 or 10 or 20 million people in his generation who had a true spiritual experience. As he wrote later, in the middle of the night, it was almost a room lit up, and like a wind blowing. And he didn't know what it was. He thought he was going insane. He talked to the doctor about it the morning. He said, actually, I've never seen one before, but I read about him in the literature. They may be one of these spiritual experiences. But whatever it is, hang on to it, because it seems to have done something for you. Now the question would be, who cares if Ebby called on him or Roland had got Ebby on him? You'd have had the spiritual experience anyway, maybe. So what's all the difference does it make? Big difference. Because almost everybody who ever had one of these spiritual experiences took it as some kind of a religious call and got active in church work. But he, because he had been called upon by Ebby about his drinking, thought it had something to do with the Oxford group. So he went to the Oxford group. If he'd gone to church, we never would have heard him again. But he went to the Oxford group. He thought he had a mission to help drunks. And so for the next 6 months, he went to the Oxford group every night, or every night he could. He worked with drunks every day. He had no job to deter him. His wife was working to support him. Sounds kind of cruel, but it works in our family. And he'd bring guys home. He'd take them to the Oxford group, find these down and outers. You know, you got to have some sympathy for the people of the Oxford group. They come to their meeting, well-dressed, nice people. Maybe I can find something, a new spiritual understanding. Here's some smelly old drunk sitting next to you. I hope you find peace soon, sir. You're vomiting on my shoe. Yeah. And this heartache. This went on. And you take guys home. At the end of 6 months, you got up one morning, and the guy he had brought home the night before had decamped, stolen some stuff out of the apartment. to sell for wine, apparently. And he turned to his wife and said, "That's it. I'm not doing this anymore. I thought I had some sort of a mission to help people, but I've been trying every day and every night, and I've done the best I can, and not one person has stayed sober. I'm not going to do it anymore." I'll tell you something. The Sierra Center Serenity Retreat hung by a thin thread that morning, as did your life and mine. And fortunately for you and me, his wife turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her a few years ago in Connecticut. I said, "Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? God, it just changed the course of history." She said, "Seemed obvious to me. I don't know why I didn't think of it." But she said, when he said, "Not one, with all my efforts, not one person is sober," she said, "You are." He said, "Oh, yeah." That's why a lot of drunken, a lot of AA members don't have any hair in front after a while. Duffy and I are a good example. And so he decided to keep going. And we all know the story after that, most of us. Finally, somebody gave him a chance on a job, and he went out to Akron, Ohio to buy some proxies, and he blew that up and was about almost got drunk, and he called the Oxford group out there, and somebody got a hold of him and sent him a drunken doctor to talk to, and he got together this drunken doctor, and he didn't have train fare to go home, so the doctor fortunately said, "You want to come and stay with me and help me with my drinking?" And Bill said, "You bet." So he moved in for a couple while, and they talked about deep spiritual concepts and deep understandings. And after 2 weeks, the doctor got drunk again on a little trip. And again, our lives hung by a thin thread, folks. But he came back, and they got him home again, sobered him up one more time, sobered up the day he had to do cancer surgery. His hand was shaking. He said, "My God, I got to get a colon cancer surgery then. I got to do it. I can't hold the knife. What can I do?" And the sponsor went and bought him a drink. I knew that story years ago when I was new, and I told it to my sponsor hoping he'd get the message, but he never would, the old fool. But he went and got him a drink, and his hand stopped, and he did the surgery, and we put down the knife and the glass. That was the afternoon of June 10th, 1935. They called that the founding day of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't call it that yet, but that's what it was. And they came to the conclusion that Bill had not stayed sober in New York by talking about spiritual values. He had stayed sober by trying to help people. So this time they went up to the Akron Hospital and found some other poor boob to help. And they found a guy named Bill D, who was a lawyer from Kentucky who had moved there, and he had drunk himself into extinction. He was married to a very, very strong woman. Very strong woman. The kind of woman, when you said to Bill, "How you doing, Bill?" she'd say, "He's fine." Made me homesick, I'll tell you. Everybody's been grinding him about his drinking, and he didn't want to hear anybody anymore. He was sick of people talking about drinking. I heard him talk years ago. He said, "I was laying that bed, Akron, Ohio. My wife came in and said, 'There's two fellas want to talk to you about your drinking.' And I thought, oh, hell. I didn't want to talk to them fellas, but my wife insisted, so I did. And them two fellas talked to me, and they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. And I never heard anybody describe me quite so well. And that so impressed me, I stuck with them fellers, and I've been with them ever since." And he became AA number three. But it would become AA number three. And he worked with some other guys. Finally got a young guy, first young guy, guy named Ernie. He, of all things, fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter, and they had AA's first relationship. If you want to hear any word that makes a cold chill go down a sponsor's back, I want to talk to you about my relationship. If you're really quick, you could say, "Oh, Mr. Emerson, that is the day. He go home a long time ago. I don't know." But usually you have to listen to it. It's always the same, you know. This is really the one. I knew it. When I saw her come out of the detox, I just... Shit. But I mean, that's the way it is with young people, I think. I think sometimes we take the young people for granted, and we shouldn't. I was thinking about when the young folks were reading tonight. Well, nobody young over here, but... I saw the young folks reading. I thought, you know, we sometimes forget this. We, in my group in West LA, we have a lot of young people. And I sometimes got to remind myself to tell them that you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you're like the young people in our group, I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. But anyway, they fell in love, and he married Dr. Bob's daughter. Touching and beautiful thing. I'll tell you. If you ever, that happened to me. My own youngest daughter married a guy I'd sponsored for 5 years. And they fell in love, and I wasn't in favor of it, but they got married, and they're still married 10 years later. But if you ever want a textbook definition of mixed emotions, it's watching your daughter go down the aisle for the guy whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can hint. You can say, "Let me know if he brings a sheep home, honey." But anyway, they got married, and he, since he got married to his sponsor's daughter, he didn't have to do all the crap the others were doing, and it wasn't quite so involved after a while, because he was pretty much staying home and taking care of his wife, as he should have been, obviously. But then he got drunk and died, and made her bitter towards AA for 40 years. And it turns out, doesn't mean how good the reasons are for not doing it, it gets you sooner or later. But Bill went back to New York, and he had a little group there, and a little group in Akron, and they wrote this book, which incidentally was what we heard tonight, except the 12 traditions, most of you know, were not written for the next, they weren't introduced. The first copy of the book that had the traditions in them came out 40 years ago, this summer, edition 1951. And they had to write the traditions because AA was coming apart. And they finally, someone told Bill about the Washingtonians, and he read about them and found out how similar it was to AA. And he wrote our traditions based on the Washingtonians, most of them, and saved AA. But he wrote this book and didn't do much, but it had something. Most of us are not terribly impressed by the big book when we read it. It's a nice book, but it's, you know, it really never gets anywhere. It's just, I've been a writer all my life. I write things and say, do this, take this action, send that check, da-da-da-da-da-da. And you read this book, it's just, you are thorough at this stage of your development, you But it's a funny phenomenon about this book. I have come to believe, much to my surprise over the years, that this book may be the only book, or at least certainly no more than one of two, that I believe to be truly divinely inspired. For a couple of reasons. One, because as you go along and your experience gets greater, this book becomes truer and truer year after year after year. Secondly, the guy did not know enough to write it. He was a loser, 3 years sober. He was a bad husband. He had no job. He was a loser. He was on the take wherever he could get the dough. His office running. Borrowed here, borrowed there. And he wrote a book. And he was surrounded by people who were failing. Most of the people he worked with failed. The thing he wrote of his own volition in there, the preamble, which was absolutely, he said, we are a group of over 100 men and women who have stayed sober a year. Later he admitted there were only 79 he knew of, but 100 sounded better. We all understand that. But he wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 53 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. That is some sort of a miracle. And so 50 years ago this year, just another anniversary, they finally got an article in the Reader's or the Saturday Post. This guy's going to write an expose on AA and came to be staggered by how good it was. And he wrote an article in the Saturday Post in 1941. And it took off little by little. The other night I talked at the 50th anniversary of the South Pasadena Group in Los Angeles. They were just about all stocked by the people who came in early summer of 1941. And now AA's everywhere. Through, got to other countries, got to Canada, got to Mexico, other countries. Now it's all over. For those of you who are kind of new, AA is truly international. In the last few years, I've had the opportunity to speak at AA get-togethers in places like Christ Church in Auckland, Duffy's old stomping ground, and Tahiti, and Hawaii, and Canada, and Mexico, and Belfast, and Glasgow, and Dublin, and London, and Bristol, and Paris, Frankfurt, Berlin, all different cultures, thousands of miles apart. And the most amazing thing about this whole thing is they are all just about perfectly identical. If you can put the accent out, you think it's your home group. You know, sitting in Berlin, I remember in Berlin, hearing some boob behind me saying, "But I don't think you understand." "I'm afraid my case is different." Now there's AA in Russia. A few years ago, people brought AA to Russia. I had some question about the motives, because they had their picture on the front page of every paper that would take their picture, which is hardly the way AA goes, but however it happened. Got AA in Russia. Sure, it's doing well during Glasnost and the abolition of the Communist Party today. AA seems to weather these things. I was thinking, when I was in Belfast during the Troubles, literally you could hear explosions from time to time between the Protestants and the Catholics at each other's throats. You couldn't put them like cats and dogs. But in that meeting, the chairman was a Catholic. The guy who read Chapter 5 was a Protestant. In AA meetings, they are the only place in North Ireland where the Protestants and Catholics sit down in peace. It's amazing. And in Russia now, they've really achieved true AA status. There are two major groups there, and they are feuding. Don't go to that group. Don't go to that group. Four years ago or so, they had sent their first four AAs to from Moscow to the United States. Some of you may have heard them. They toured the country. First place they came was our group in West LA, the Pacific group. It was the biggest group in the world. I guess they want to get some exposure. But it really was nice. These four guys who couldn't speak English, little blonde interpreter, a phony imitation priest for them who was trying to make his... Well, I don't judge. But anyway, it really was funny. Call on this guy, he's up there says, and she'd say, he says he loves you very much. And I thought to myself, I'll bet that's what that son of a bitch said. I'll bet he said, we'll bury you in the steps, gringo. But now AA is everywhere. For those of you who are kind of new, aren't you glad? Not necessary to die from drinking anymore. Not necessary to go insane. There's AA everywhere, all over the world, and of all the world, the hot spot of the world, obviously the United States. There's AA everywhere. I started as a little town called Pony, Montana, which is about 100 miles beyond any length. There's 80 people in this town that had a little AA meeting with 750 people in it. Come for just a... I opened the meeting by reading a portion of Chapter 5 from Field and Stream. Well, that may not be correct. But of all of AA, the number one place, you're in the, right out Southern California, starting right about here. This is the hotbed of the world. There are more sober AAs south of here in California than there are in New York and Illinois combined. There are still people who think that the heart of AA is Akron, Ohio. Akron, Ohio has the same relationship to AA that Bethlehem has to Christianity. Something nice happened there once, but not for a long time. So now you live in a where you can't hardly help but stay sober. So all we have to do is get together like this, have a few laughs, a few grins. When you see somebody having a drinking problem, invite them in, and we're home free. There's only one kind of negative cloud today in America, this great place of recovery. It is estimated today in America that over 90% of alcoholics still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. And you wonder, how can this be? Have you ever seen anybody dying drunk? Of course I do. I see people dying drunk a lot, or intermittently. When I go to work in the morning, I have to step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. And when I go home at night, I step over the bodies of dying men and women to go home. And I know that people die, but of course you say, well, you're on Skid Row, of course. That's true. I see people dying on Skid Row. But that's only 3% of alcoholic deaths, it's estimated. 97% are people who look like you and me, who drink and drink and finally get hidden somewhere and obscured. Don't ever be on Skid Row, that you're not on the sidewalk. Someone is taking care of you somewhere. State or family or something. But why would people die from drinking when it's so unnecessary? It really is just bottles of wine. Now, every so often, I, and I'm sure Duffy does, and people talk around about it, I get a letter from somebody who says, boy, I heard you talk in Berlin, and you really helped me. I get a letter saying, you helped me when you talked in Auckland. Now, these people, I wouldn't know if they never saw me. But I see people that I know and like dying in front of me on the street, And I would rather help them than all those abstract people in New Zealand. And I can't touch them. The big communicator can't touch them. Why not? Because of the reason that people die from alcoholism, I believe. And it's something that, to my opinion, all of us, the feeling, it's due to a feeling we all have within us, and we will always have it within us. And so we must always work on it so it does not move from feeling to obsession. When it comes to obsession, you die. You keep as a feeling. You know what that is? Nothing mystic, nothing mysterious. Just that little sure knowledge that comes every so often and says, but my case truly is different. And there isn't a person here, I'm sure, who doesn't have that feeling once in a while. And if you don't remember having it, the next time you're hungry or cross or feel betrayed or feel lonely or you're not getting enough sleep, you will see the feeling come running by. But I am different. I am different. Now, there's nothing wrong with that because we do things here that treat that to keep it. But when you don't treat it, it becomes an obsession and becomes, it's like a glass piece of armor. You can see through it, but you can't communicate through it. Look, I can help you. I know you mean well, Clancy, but you don't understand. Funny, huh? But you ought to come down and watch them die sometime. You have a lot of laughs. And they die. And I got to get them out of there. And it's sad. And it's just terrible. But that's quite obvious. But why do I want to shake these people and say, for Christ's sake, do something. But they can't. They're beyond it. They're in an obsession. If I get so cross, then I stop and think, if it was that easy to get them out of it, why did I spend 9 years in and out of AA with good people trying to help me? Good men in Chicago and Milwaukee and Beloit and San Francisco and El Paso and Dallas and Los Angeles and Minneapolis and city after city. Good people trying to help me. And my answer was always the same, and mentally, I really appreciate what you're trying to do, but you don't understand. That sort of thing doesn't help cases like mine. And I believe that case of, but my case is different, is the most lethal thing, unless it's treated, that I know of. And I look back at my life, but I'm sure I can't believe it's terribly different from yours. Why was my case different? Because I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and it seemed apparent to me alcoholics were people whose problem was alcohol, and they treated their alcohol problems and they got kind of shaped up and they felt better. And it became obvious to me that I'm not like that. There's something deep and there's something wrong with my emotions. There's something down deep, not all the time, but sometimes. It's almost as though my emotions are too intense somehow, that I feel things too strongly, it's almost that I'm too vulnerable. People can just destroy me sometimes. People can just make me feel less than. I've studied my emotions for years, but I guess if I wanted to synthesize them in a digest, it would be most of my life I've spent feeling not quite enough, not knowing why. I've known why from time to time, but it didn't, I knew why in psychoanalysis, and I knew why in metaphysics, and I knew why in reading Nietzsche, but they're all transitory answers. But the answer was this: somehow of myself I am not quite enough, and somehow of myself I am too vulnerable to live in this world. I can act tough and I can be mean, but goddammit, I'm too vulnerable. I'm some kind of insane. And I went to the psychoanalysis. I discovered a lot of things there. I discovered that I'd been psychologically scarred as a child by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. That hurt my feelings when I found that out. Because I always liked the Norwegian Lutheran Church. They really only had two rules. Don't sin and don't monkey with Catholics. And but in their fall, I was weak. I sinned and I monkeyed with Catholics. And I found out that they had really hurt me. And I felt bad about that. In fact, if I knew in the 1950s what I know now, I would have formed Adult Children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple of codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I have a granddaughter who is graduating from the University of New Mexico this year. And she has, I'm sorry to say, she has a weird sense of humor like her grandpa. She and I seem to be closer than... I'm going to tell you a little bit of truth now. I don't know if you can put it on the tape or not, because I don't want ordinary people to know this. But I've discovered why grandchildren and grandparents get along so well. They share a common enemy. That's worth your lousy trip right there. But I'm trying to get her to form a chapter at the University of Michigan, the first chapter of children, of adult children of alcoholics, just so we can have a group called Kaka. Don't hold me back, folks. I hear the band tuning up. But I discovered other things. I got into metaphysics. I read books. I did a lot of things. I was trying hard to be something, because you don't feel like you're very much. It gives you a great sense of ambition. Nothing's ever enough. And when I was a boy, 15 years old, on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War, some men intimidated me into drinking some alcohol. And I didn't like it, and I hated it. I threw it up, and I drank some more later, and I threw it up, drank some more later. But one day I held it down, and that was the first day I ever discovered that alcohol really is a good thing. I could talk about this and that and explosions and all this, but put it in the sake of argument for tonight. Alcohol took a person who was not enough and made them slightly more than enough. And took someone vulnerable and made him momentarily invulnerable. With a feeling of momentary omnipotence. I didn't know the words then, but I know I have a feeling. And then I got sick and threw up and it went away. But for a little while, I felt that. And over the years, I tried to learn how to drink, because I knew that people drank. I tried to learn how to drink, and I was the first. At the end of the war, I was in Pleasant in California, Naval Hospital, and I took some tests up there that enabled me to get a high school equivalency so I could go to college after the war, and I was the first post-war class of veterans. Steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. Hoping nobody notices you're a wimp. And went to college. Got married in college. I was so free of my earlier bondage, I married a Catholic. My grandma said, "Oh, don't marry a Catholic." I said, "Grandma, we went over there in the Pacific fighting the forces of fascism, so we don't have this religious bigotry." So I married this girl, and my grandma was right. It's not that she was a bad girl. She was a good girl. Really a good girl. And there's something they never tell Lutheran boys. If you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family, whether you want to or not. I So I added to my career by becoming a national distributor of small Catholics. I used to plead with them. I said, can't we use birth control? No. I went to the whip. I said, we don't have to take orders from some old goof wearing a white dress in Rome. He had a priest come by one day and he gave me an hour and a half on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control, and I listened intently and I just couldn't pick up that beat. Really kidding. Now you can laugh. This girl doesn't laugh unless somebody's dying. I think that's the difference between us. When Duffy and I, and maybe some of you yesterday, you were kids, there are a lot of differences in the world, but I think as major a difference as I know. When I was a kid, young guy, you'd walk into a drugstore and you'd say, hey, give me a pack of cigarettes. And some condoms. Now, at least in my neighborhood, they walk in and say, hey, give me some condoms. And some cigarettes. And boobs. I guess that's progress. But over the years, I tried to learn to drink. And I drank, and I'll tell you something. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. When all else fails, alcohol made me feel enough, slightly more than enough. Added a little technicolor to a drab, cold, hostile world. Enabled me to do things. And the only problem is, sometimes I drank too much. Sometimes I didn't intend to stay drunk, but I did. Could get drunk. You know, that's another thing that I've been thinking about recently. These are just my opinions, of course. But for me, I think I've come to identify the craving. People have been trying to find out what makes this craving for years. Nobody's ever found out. But let me submit this to try it out for size. I think, as best I can determine it, when drinking does that for you, it's great. But alcohol has a quick fade. It fades quickly. As you start to fade, you take another drink to hold it. And you crave another drink to hold it. Well, you're not really physically craving the drink. You're craving the desire to hold that edge, to be something. And eventually you get drunk. You don't intend to. In fact, I'm sure some of you like me find yourself at bars in the daytime and get drunk and go outside and it's in the middle of the afternoon and the sun is out. It's depressing. And if you're like me also, maybe you've done what I've done. A lot of times I've gone into sleazy bar toilets and put my fingers on my throat to throw it up so I would have the feeling without being drunk. Get the booze out. But I always wound up in trouble. And eventually, people thought I had a drinking problem. I was set to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. And it's like it is now. Nice people. Simple solutions. But I knew even then, there's something different about me. And I went to AA meetings off and on for the next years because people would, hey, it was not as well known as it is now. And you could always hustle an employer and say, well, maybe you're right, Mr. Carlson. Maybe I'm going to try that Alcoholics Anonymous and see if that works. And yes, good idea. At least give you a couple of weeks to look. And I, in and out, and in and out, and the last day I drank, I had done something and it was all gone now. I found myself being thrown out of a skid row mission. My front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail. And I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write. These L.C. Delmer ads for the Gordon Company were running that very week in Life and Collier's and Saving Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, if you have no front teeth, you can't really punch out those consonants quite as cleanly. And I stood outside of that skid row, Mr. I'll tell you, if a guy would come up and said, "Your life depends on the answer, kid. You an alcoholic?" I said, "No, I'm not. But I wish I were. I wish my life were not so complex. I wish stopping drinking along the way and shaping up would have helped. But there's too much black inside of me. There's something about me. And when I stop drinking too long, I'm not enough." The one time I tried to stay sober any length of time was in Texas for my wife's pregnancy, another one of her pregnancies. I determined to help her. And it got so bad one day I couldn't stand it. And when she was at church, I tried to commit suicide. I promised I wouldn't drink, but I couldn't stand it. I was put in a state mental hospital for that. Not as an alcoholic, so I hadn't any drinking, but as a paranoid schizophrenic. And I was there for an indefinite period. I almost didn't get out. I got a lot of shock treatments. The next year they put in an alcoholic ward in that hospital, first one in the state of Texas, Big Spring. And I'd been in and out of AA for 7 years by this time, so I know how to pretend to be an alcoholic. And I used them to get out. But that's not an alcohol problem. That's something deeper and much more complex. Emotions and feelings and... So I stood outside of a Skid Row mission and I walked 71 blocks out to the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax with a little AA club that I'd been asked to leave a week before for fighting drunkenly. I hung around that club. And for a while I lived in the back seat of an abandoned car in the parking lot, some old Mercury, some tall grass. I hung around there, I got into a terrible funk. I guess what happened to me about that time is I often thought about this. I didn't know it either. It happened to Roland, happened to others. I came to the conclusion my case was hopeless. There was no help for me. I would just hang on best I could. Maybe I could hustle some of these wimps and get out of here. Could you bring me a Braunschweiger on rye while you're up? Sure, I can squeeze some out of this dry cup. And they did the same thing them as they do. I said, Here's Pastor. I got a sponsor. Kind of seen in the movies as a character actor. He was a loving kind of guy. Turned out these were just roles he played. He was a dictator, intimidating, terrible person. You know, I thought about that later. Two or three occasions I was going to resign him as my sponsor. Bob? Yeah! Never mind. You know, that's really stupid. But he'd always get me to do things. And I thought over the years, where did I turn? What changed? I'll tell you. What changed is this. There was one day that I took an inventory. I swore I'd never take the day. I almost killed myself and took an inventory. That was a great turning spot. There were several great turning spots. But what I think... Even before that, the preliminary turning spot that changed my life. I thought about this a little bit recently. I was about 5.5 months sober. I just moved off a guy's sofa back in that stinking car. I was hanging around the club. I was at the Central Hollywood meeting one night, which was a weird meeting. Funny people. Spiked hair. 20 years before spiked hair came in. That's the meeting that Bela Lugosi used to go to get off drugs, you know. Don't bite my neck, you some bitch. Turn into a bat around here, will you? But anyway, and it was a participation meeting. And I didn't get called on. This was the coffee break. I stayed by the point of the coffee break. I went to a lot of meetings. I always got called on once. And I told them what I really thought, and I never got called on again. So much for honesty.
And I sat there, and I saw a girl. She was about sitting right there, but I was watching her. I was thinking to myself, I'd never get called on these stinking sick pukes. And saw this girl, maybe her name was Mary Alice, seemed like it was. And I was studying her for a while. I said, she was really, she's the epitome of what newcomers hate in AA. She was about 3 years sober. Everybody loved her. And she sponsored people. And she was asked to do things. And she talked. And let's ask Mary Alice. You know, the kind of person you just want to... You know, I was sitting there thinking, I wonder what if they'd say if I'd just go and smash her in her face once. And here comes my sponsor. Said, Posse! Yeah? So I want you to apologize to Mary Alice. Is this son of a bitch reading my mind? Maybe I should have got Bela Lugosi to be my sponsor. I said, why? He said, someone told me last. Incidentally, if you want to get a sponsor, get one without snitches. If they got snitches, there's never a moment's peace. People are like, did you hear what you do now? If your baby did now? Somebody told me last night, the Frank Randall group, that you called Mary Alice a bitch. And Bob, she really is a bitch. Thank you, David. And he said, why do you think so? I said, she told her new girl not to go to bed with me. He said, well, she was absolutely right. Don't apologize. And the worst part about it is she could hear all this and was watching. And I thought, this is the end. I have been hungry and sick and abused for 5.5 months. I'm not even an alcoholic and I'm being screwed around the clock. But this is the absolute nadir of human goddamn expression. And I thought to myself, I'm going to resign from AA. I'm going to let him know exactly what I think of him and his stinking second-rate stuff. I used to be a good writer. I think in my mind's eye, I think, I'll say, Bob, why don't you take these 12 golden steps of recovery, perhaps season them with the 12 traditions which are of the group as the steps out of the individual. Perhaps you could garnish them with the 12 concepts of world service. Wrap them all in the 12 promises that never come true to anybody with any sense. And stick them up your goddamn nose, because I've had enough. Now, just about to... Ah, I knew if I told him this, you just turned white. But he deserved it. Now, just about to give him this, and suddenly a ray of light came out of heaven and illuminated me. Actually, it was just a passing thought, but it's more dramatic. Would you rather be Saul of Tarsus or Clancy of Venice, I say? Well, I had this passing thought. What in hell am I doing? I'm making too big a deal out of this. I've been doing this all wrong. I act as though I have to mean these dumb things he has me do. I don't have to mean them. I can ridicule them while I do them. And laugh at them. That's the old fool who thinks he's doing right, and I can... Okay, Bob.
Sorry, Mary Alice.
You lousy bitch. So then I became quite an activist. Sponsor. So get the cups out for me. Sure, Bob. I didn't say it, but I could think. You want to know why you can't get any more roles and pictures? Because you're a crazy old bastard. That's right. And everybody knows it except you. I did a lot of things. They got me so convinced that a month later I was going to commit suicide. I called them instead and took an inventory. And little by little, my life started to get better by taking actions I did not believe in for the worst possible motives. I begin to understand after a while why Alcoholics Anonymous says action is the magic word. Not spiritual breakthrough, not deep understanding. Actions are the magic word. They change. When I stayed sober, that's been a lot of years. Now, I'm doing very well. I'm sure there are some new people here tonight. I'm doing very well. Eventually my family came back. We had another Catholic. But I bought a timekeeping device then. I've had a lot of children. Only one ever went really bad. She, kind of hate to say this in AA meeting, she's Assistant Attorney General for the state of New Mexico. Never thought one of my kids would go into law enforcement. But maybe she'll straighten out later. She's the highest ranking AA in that state government. Doing good. No, those kids are all right. Except the one won't have that baby time for me to be eased off for tomorrow. But, this is the moment when speakers all say, I'm doing well, everything is fine, got a job I love, got dough in my pocket. Then you try to find a newcomer. Do we have any, is there anybody in their first 30 days here at all? First 6 months? You don't have to say anything, I just want to see your hand. Are you? I want to be able to look at you, because you have to find somebody new, because you have to give them the look. You don't say it, but you give them the look. I've got it all together, and you haven't. And probably never will. But we all hear those kind of stories. I want to get this quick now. But the most important thing I've said tonight, or I'll say before I sit down, I said, my name is Clancy, because I'm an alcoholic. How can I be an alcoholic? My problem is not alcohol. It's much more complex than that. I'm glad that I took actions I didn't believe in and survived here long enough to discover the most important single thing I have ever learned about my life or the life of these people around me. Now, I want to say this slowly. If you hear nothing else I say, some of you heard me say it before, but you're going to hear it again. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to learn these things. Let me say one thing in passing. I don't want to offend anybody. But I sometimes go to other towns and I hear little AA meetings where they're talking about analysis and they're talking about their inner child and they're talking about all of this crap. And that has no place in an AA meeting. I don't go to their goddamn meetings and talk about the 12 steps. And it really, the only thing that has ever worked for alcoholics in the history of the world, and people want to come in here and tell them what they've learned by sending money to some old charlatan in Texas. Bullshit. All right. Well, I don't want to judge. I just... Take that off the tape with you. But if you hear somebody talking about things other than this, we have a program of recovery here. We don't care why your inner child feels stifled. We want you to get better, for Christ's sake. All right. But anyway, I discovered this. And I discovered it here. And if you discover this, you'll be on your way home to success. I discovered if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And I discovered if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not and cannot be alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound strange and unrelated to our specific problem? But I'm convinced that's the message of AA, that's the message of this book, that's the message of everything we do here. And I'm sure I'm one of the very few in this room, maybe the only one, who's spent an hour talking to Bill Wilson about it. And that's what he felt, 1963. But she said, of course alcohol is the problem. It's got to be. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If the problem is alcohol, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. Treatment facilities turn out recovered people. They don't. They turn out people who are detoxified and with varying amounts of information. But if something dramatic doesn't happen, if they be alcoholics of our type, but I presume you're that type too, or you wouldn't be here, they eventually will drink again. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something secret they're not telling us? Is it something that the old-timers are keeping to themselves? No, it's something you hear every day of your life. Almost, I bet. Certainly every time you go to a meeting. The problem is something called alcoholism. You say, well, alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. And I'll tell you, if you be an alcoholic of our type, the day will come when I promise you, your life will depend on remembering the difference. So what's the difference? A lot of differences. But if we can synthesize it by saying this, an alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and shaping up. In this strange, destructive, eroding, mind-destroying, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. The thing that makes alcoholism a fatal disease is the growing discomfort of sobriety. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. That just predisposes you to be an alcoholic. So a lot of people like that who aren't alcoholics, they're called intense or acute neurotics. They fill the psychiatric cultures of the world, and they are the ones for whom the drugs like Valium and Darvon and Thorazine were invented to help. Intense neurotics on a conflict course. Something else must be present. In this book, it says they were groping. They didn't know much about it. They called it an allergy of the body. Another doctor, Silkworth, called it an extreme sensitivity of the body. But something has to happen different. Now, what is this different reaction that you don't even know is different, and people who die from it don't know they got it? Is it you stay drunk all the time? No, you can't stay drunk 2 weeks in a laboratory, night and day. Can't handle alcohol? False. Alcoholics in almost any test will handle a given amount of alcohol better than social drinkers. Maybe you makes you act crazy. Some people it does. You hear these speakers, I escaped from Leavenworth and raped 9 nuns and, oh, that's helpful. But I see men die who've never been bizarre once. It's like they get more and more catatonic. Gotta shake them to see if they're alive. Then what is it? What does alcohol do to me? It doesn't do to 96% of the people who drink it. Turns out nothing. It does less to me than it does to them. Then what is it? The one thing I never would have dreamed in a million years. It has to do something special for me, not to me, for me. We could talk about all the wonderful things it has to do, but let's put it for the sake of argument. It has to take people who feel less than and make them more than. It must make everything almost instantly all right. Now, we just take that for granted. But it's hard to realize it doesn't do that for nearly all the other people. That's why they can't understand why we drink, and we cannot understand why they do not. There's a different reaction. If it does that for you, there's no drug that I know of on a continuing basis. Heroin will never get you there on a continuing basis. Cocaine will never get you there on a continuing basis. If you be an alcoholic, it will bring you to fruition again and again and again. But eventually alcohol gets to be a problem. Anything you become psychologically dependent on, then you have some problems because other people have had to cope with their problems, but I haven't. Because when it got bad enough, I drank and changed my perception of reality. So now I'm going to stay sober. And it's very painful. But I'm going to drink. I'm in trouble. So I'm going to stay sober. It's painful. Tonight when they read chapter 3, they did not go on to the paragraph that sounds so funny to new people. Things people do. Change from scotch to brandy, drink beer only, only drink at home, never drink at home, read spiritual literature, all these things, people, ha 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 ha. But we've all done those things. You know why they do? Very simple reason. You do when you get to the point where drinking is problems and I can't stand sobriety and I'm trying to find something that will be a compromise that will work. Maybe if I just drink at home. Maybe if I change what I drink. Maybe if I read some spiritual literature. Maybe if I move somewhere else. But the point is, I can't stay sober, and I can't drink for Christ's sake. Eventually. That phenomenon is called alcoholism. And an awful lot of people die from it and live lives of agony. And I would bet this. The people who die from it die convinced of one thing. At least all the ones I've ever seen die convinced of it. But you don't understand. I am not really an alcoholic. My case is different. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank for relief. And they don't realize they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. But they can prove they don't have it till they die from it. Or go worse than die, live in agony year after year. And not on Skid Row. I mean, a few years ago, the world's richest man had to go to meetings. Just like us. And movie stars, and doctors, and lawyers, and ditch diggers. And got a call last Thursday from one of the biggest stars in Hollywood. And they interceded, would you please talk to me next Wednesday night at the meeting, because I can't hold it together. You know, that sounds exciting, but it really isn't, because once you go by him, it's like the guy in Germany. It's the same thing. How could I break down the wall of saying, but you don't understand, my case is different. Because unless something, and that's why it's necessary for us to realize the problem here is not alcohol. More people die from thinking it's alcohol. They come to AA, they go to the meetings, they hang around, and pretty soon they get very uncomfortable. And they realize AA doesn't work for me like it does for them, and they leave. I'm sure there are millions of people who have done that. But they don't realize they've never been in AA. Being sober is the front porch of AA. That's where you get to the front porch. But the natural state of progressive sobriety is growing anxiety and depression. And eventually the time comes when no matter how much sociability you have, you start to feel bad. Then a lot of people leave. But we must remember that is when AA must start. That's when you got to go into the house. That's where AA is. And in that house is involvement and commitments and actions, whether you believe in them or not. And hopefully finding a sponsor that you will respect enough that you will let that sponsor superimpose actions over your thoughts, and you will do them whether you believe in them or not. And eventually, over a long period of time, you'll take 12 steps at this. One of the worst things treatment facilities do today, I think, they send guys out after 28 days and they're convinced they've worked the steps. And you can say to them, let's work the steps. Done it, not going to do it anymore. And it's funny, except it kills them. There's no way you can work 28 steps in 12 or 12 steps in 28 days. They say some of the steps you can get done, some of the steps go forever. It's like the old saying goes, it's like peeling an onion. This is the layer I need off. Oh, this is the layer I need off. Oh, this is the layer I need. I like onions every so often you cry. Oh, shit. That's it. So that's what we got to do. We got to remember, being sober is not the answer. Involvement and actions and being part of it. And it's so tough because sometimes our mind says, go. Structure. That's why a lot of times structure, a little structure in your AA life helps. Because structure is what gets you to keep taking actions when your head wants you to quit. You just do it. I was going to get drunk tonight, but I can't because I've got to make the coffee Saturday night, but then I'll get drunk. Involvements and commitments and actions. So you're not here yet, so we've got to keep doing these things together. Just before I sit down, I want to give an illustration of how that still works in my life sometimes. When I was about 4 years sober, I wanted to be secretary of a meeting. I got a guy to nominate me and died for lack of a second. I really didn't have much of a following. And I can't understand why, can you? So somebody said, gee, there's an open night Tuesday night at Ohio Street. The meeting had just died, so I leaped in there. I started the meeting, got 8 tattered followers, and we started the meeting. I wrote a format, still used word for word. And the second week we had 12 members, and the third week we had 20 members. Then I offended some people in the announcements, we were back to 9 members. And this went on for a year. I finally worked that baby through self-worth and my own grit up to about 50 people. And I just happened to remember thinking about that. God's end of May is a year. I thought, well, some meetings have elections, but now these people, I would be doing them a disservice by having an election because they're not quite ready. They're like an emerging African nation, mate. So I sacrificed myself and became secretary another year. Then the second year we had about 80 people. I thought, well, almost. God, they're so close to self. Like the Russians are now. I mean, they mean well, but they'd have no basis for voting. So I didn't have another election that year. I just said, well, I'll sacrifice myself. Well, just a while longer. Some guy came up and said, you know, Clancy, some of the people in the other groups are wondering why we don't have an election. I said, well, he said, I know that by far, you know, you're in this group. You're the heart of this group. Nobody knows that. But if you had an election, then we could say that we elected you. I said, okay, I understand that. So I had an election. I said, no. I've been secretary for 2 years. Maybe you shouldn't re-elect me, but try to get the best qualified person, whoever it is. And they swept me out of office. Just a ploy to hurt me. But I knew I'd built a good foundation. As soon as I stopped being secretary, the meeting really took off. Now, thanks a lot, kid. Now it's about 1,200 people. Biggest group in the world. Some of you have been there. And I have no role to play. I do, but I'm the founder. And I sit there in the middle, and I give little signals. Nobody pays any attention, but it makes me feel good. And at the end of the meeting, I stand in the back, these people all milling around, and I'm the founder, and I see people bring their newcomers up. This is Clancy. He speaks all over the world. He founded this group. He's very famous. Hello there. Welcome to AA. I hope you find what we found here, and we'll be with you in this journey. I do that well. I'm just syrup pouring on their heads. Just, but every so often, some puke will come up who doesn't know who I am. Hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward? And the wonderful thing about the AA is this, it's hold true since I got sober in 1958. You can think whatever you want to. I can look right in his beady eyes and think, what? For Christ's sake, there are 1,200 people in this room who need action, who are doing nothing. There's one who has been drained dry for over 3 decades on a daily basis. For Christ's sake, get them to give you a ride back to your sick hospital. I've got a role to play here. I've got to reassure people. I'm not just some guy. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky with a message for hundreds of thousands. Now I can think that as long as I say, okay. And the wonderful miracle of AA is this. After I dropped this boob off at the VA hospital and driving home, my head says, oh Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? Action is the magic word. Involvement, action, other things are wonderful. Love, serenity. All these things are very nice. Spirituality. Because sometimes you get spirituality mixed up with religion. Not religion. Remember Dr. Jung said, you have to have a spiritual experience. None of us had a spiritual experience, yet we're staying sober. How can you explain that? I think it can be topped off by remembering. Nobody understood this at the beginning. They understand it now, I think. Alcoholics Anonymous did something that nothing else has ever done in the treatment of alcoholism. It brings about an incremental spiritual experience. Not the way Bill Wilson got his, boom, but the way we get ours. Make amends for that bitch. And one day we're here. Now, Bill Wilson almost quit and got drunk after 6 months. So people like us probably will quit and get drunk if we stop doing it too. So let's stay involved. And let's remember we gather together to have fun, but the primary gist of getting together is to reduce our differences so we can treat those feelings of difference that they will never become obsessions and kill us. So I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. Glad that action continues to work. I'm glad that I have continual reminders that AA continues to flourish. I've heard Karen talk many times and Duffy many times. And here are two really cases of people like me who should not be functioning in the world at all. They should be somewhere else under lock and key. But here we are, safe and sane and sober, because we take advantage of this. Let us not follow this up with money-making hypothesis from somebody else. Let's make this work. We'll be glad we did. Thank you.